As the chapters were slowly roughed out, I read them to the New York group at its weekly meeting in our parlor at Clinton Street. And copies were sent to Dr. Bob for checking and criticism in Akron, where we had nothing but the warmest support. But in the New York meeting, the chapters got a real mauling. I redictated them, and Ruth retyped them over and over. In spite of the heated arguments, the New York group's criticisms did help a lot, and to some extent, their enthusiasm and confidence increased. So the job went until we reached the famous Chapter 5. Up to that time, I had done my own story and had drafted three more chapters with the titles There Is a Solution, More About Alcoholism, and We Agnostics. It was now realized that we had enough background and window dressing material, and at this point, we would have to tell how our program for recovery from alcoholism really worked. The backbone of the book would have to be fitted in right here. This problem had secretly worried the life out of me. I had never written anything before, and neither had any other member of the New York group. Progress on the book had been too slow for several of the stock subscribers, and they had slacked off on their contributions. The hassling over the four chapters already finished had really been terrific. I was exhausted. On many a day, I felt like throwing the book out the window. I was in this anything but spiritual mood on the night when the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous were written. I was sore and tired clear through. I lay in bed at 182 Clinton Street with pencil in hand and with a tablet of scratch paper on my knee. I could not get my mind on the job, much less put my heart in it. But here was one of those things that had to be done. Slowly, my mind came into some kind of focus. Since Ebbie's visit to me in the fall of 1934, we had gradually evolved what we called the word-of-mouth program. Most of the basic ideas had come from the Oxford groups, William James and Dr. Silkworth. Though subject to considerable variation, it all boiled down into a pretty consistent procedure which comprised six steps. These were approximately as follows. 1, we admitted that we were licked, that we were powerless over alcohol. 2, we made a moral inventory of our defects or sins. 3, we confessed or shared our shortcomings with another person in confidence. 4, we made restitution to all those we had harmed by our drinking. 5, we tried to help other alcoholics with no thought of reward in money or prestige. 6, we prayed to whatever God we thought there was for power to practice these precepts. This was the substance of what, by the fall of 1938, we were telling newcomers. Several of the Oxford group's other ideas and attitudes had been definitely rejected, including any which could involve us in theological controversy. In important matters, there was still considerable disagreement between the Eastern and Midwestern viewpoints. Our people out there were still active Oxford group members, while we in New York had withdrawn a year before. In Akron and vicinity, they still talked about the Oxford group's absolutes: absolute honesty, absolute purity, absolute unselfishness, and absolute love. This dose was found to be too rich for New Yorkers, and we had abandoned the expressions. But all of us, East and West, were placing increasing emphasis on Dr. Silkworth's expression describing the alcoholic's dilemma, the obsession plus the allergy. By now, we knew from experience that the new prospect had to accept step one or get no place. This particular evening, as my mind ran over these developments, it seemed to me that the program was still not definite enough. It might be a long time before readers of the book in distant places and lands could be personally contacted. Therefore, our literature would have to be as clear and comprehensive as possible. Our steps would have to be more explicit. There must not be a single loophole through which the rationalizing alcoholic could wiggle out. Maybe our six chunks of truth should be broken up into smaller pieces. Thus, we could better get the distant reader over the barrel, and at the same time, we might be able to broaden and deepen the spiritual implications of our whole presentation. So far as I can remember, this was all I had in mind when the writing began. Finally, I started to write. I set out to draft more than 6 steps. How many more? I did not know. I relaxed and asked for guidance. With a speed that was astonishing, considering my jangling emotions, I completed the first draft. It took perhaps half an hour. The words kept right on coming. When I reached a stopping point, I numbered the new steps. They added up to 12. Somehow, this number seemed significant. Without any special rhyme or reason, I connected them with the 12 apostles. Feeling greatly relieved now, I commenced to reread the draft. At this moment, a couple of late callers arrived. One of them was my boon companion of those days, Howard A. With him was a newcomer, dry, barely 3 months. I was greatly pleased with what I had written, and I read them the new version of the program, now the 12 steps. Howard and his friend reacted violently. "Why 12 steps?" they demanded. And then, "You've got too much God in these steps. You will scare people away." And, "What do you mean by getting those drunks down on their knees when they ask to have all their shortcomings removed? And who wants all their shortcomings removed anyhow?" As he saw my uneasiness, Howard added, "Well, some of this stuff does sound pretty good after all, but, Bill, you've got to tone it down. It's too stiff. The average alcoholic just won't buy it the way it stands." I sprang to the defense of the new creation, every single word of it. A terrific discussion developed, which cooled only when Lois turned up a couple of hours later. "Why don't you forget about it for a while," she said, "and have a cup of coffee." This we did. Akronites like Paul and Dick S. liked the new steps very much. As the remainder of the book text developed, based on the 12 steps, they continued to report their approval. But in New York, the hot debate about the 12 steps and the book's contents was doubled and redoubled. There were conservative, liberal, and radical viewpoints. Fitz M., the Episcopal minister's son from Maryland and the second man to recover at Towns Hospital, made constant journeys to New York in order to reinforce the conservative position. Fitz thought that the book ought to be Christian in the doctrinal sense of the word, and that it should say so. He was in favor of using biblical terms and expressions to make this clear. Another early New York AA, Paul K., was even more emphatic about this. The liberals were the largest contingent, and they had no objection to the use of the word God throughout the book, but they were dead set against any other theological proposition. They would have nothing to do with doctrinal issues. Spirituality, yes, but religion, no, positively no. Most of our members, they pointed out, believed in some sort of deity, but when it came to theology, we could not possibly agree among ourselves. So how could we write a book that contained any such matter? There was no such thing as group opinion in these areas, and there never could be. Alcoholics who had tried the missions were forever complaining about this very thing. The alcoholics' unreasoning rebellion against the specifically religious approach had severely handicapped the missions. The liberals said they did not intend to be critical. They only wanted us to remember the hard facts. These contentions could not be denied. It was true that we could not agree on a religious basis for our fellowship, and that the straight religious approach had worked in relatively few cases. Thus, the spiritual pitch and tone of our book was greatly influenced by the liberals. But the atheists and agnostics, our radical left wing, were still to make a tremendously important contribution. Led by my friend Henry and obstinately backed by Jim B., a recently arrived salesman, this contingent proceeded to have its innings. At first, they wanted the word God deleted from the book entirely. Henry had come to believe in some sort of universal power, but Jimmy still flabbergasted us by denouncing God at our meetings. Some members had been so angered that they wanted to throw him out of the group. But most of us thought it better to let him talk on, believing that eventually he would change his mind, which he later did. What Henry, Jimmy, and company wanted was a psychological book, which would lure the alcoholic in. Once in, the prospect could take God or leave him alone, as he wished. To the rest of us, this was a shocking proposal. But happily, we listened and eventually learned something of great value. Actually, our group conscience was at work to construct the most acceptable and effective book possible. Every voice in it was playing its appointed part to create an outcome that was to be nothing less than providential. As the one who had to do the writing, I was caught squarely in the middle of all this arguing. The liberals were the larger group, but they barely outnumbered the combined conservatives and radicals. For a while, it looked as if we would bog down into permanent disagreement. Despairing of satisfying everyone, I finally asked that I might be the final judge of what the book said. Seeing that we would get nowhere without such a point of decision, most of the group agreed. We began to carry on again. We had not gone much farther with the text of the book when it was evident that something more was needed. There would have to be a story or case history section. We would have to produce evidence in the form of living proof, written testimonials of our membership itself. It was felt also that the story section could identify us with a distant reader in a way that the text itself might not. At this point, Dr. Bob and the Akronites played a vital role. The Akron group was the larger and had more case history material, and the means of putting it into story form now appeared. 2 years earlier, a former newspaper man, Jim S., had been lifted off Skid Row and nursed back to health and sobriety. Jim and Dr. Bob went after all the Akronites who had substantial sobriety records for testimonial material. In most cases, Jim interviewed the prospects and wrote their stories for them. Dr. Bob wrote his own. By January, the Akronites had produced 18 fine stories. Two of them came from Clevelanders who had attended the Akron meeting, and one concerned Marie B., the wife of an Akron alcoholic, an early forerunner of today's family group development. With somewhat more difficulty, the New York group produced 10 stories. At the time, we were an oddly assorted crowd. Since New York had no one comparable to Akron's newsman, Jim, it was thought that each New Yorker with a real record of sobriety could try to write a story himself. None of us had had any writing experience, and when Henry and I tried to edit these amateur attempts, there was plenty of trouble. Who were we, said the writers, to edit their stories? That was a good question, but still, we did edit them. The cries of the anguished, edited tale-tellers finally subsided, and the story section of the book was complete in the latter part of January 1939. So, at last, was the text. The end of our money supply was definitely in sight, and we were preparing to rush the book to press. But someone, I do not remember who, sounded a note of caution. These points were raised. How do we know for sure that this book will be widely acceptable to everybody? Maybe it still contains medical errors or material that might offend our friends of religion. Had we not better make a pre-publication copy of the text and some of the stories and try the book out on our own membership and on every kind and class of person that has anything to do? This method would consume still more time and money, and many objected, but at length we concluded that we had better be safe than sorry. 400 mimeograph copies of the book were made and sent to everyone we could think of who might be concerned with the problem of alcoholism. Each mimeograph was stamped loan copy in order to protect our coming copyright. While we were waiting for the returns to come in, two hot controversies got underway. Though I had labeled the mimeograph issue Alcoholics Anonymous, this title was still unacceptable to a great many people. The Akron and New York groups had been voting for months on possible titles. This had become an after-the-meeting form of amusement and interest. The title Alcoholics Anonymous had appeared very early in the discussion, probably in October 1938. We do not know who first used these words. After we New Yorkers had left the Oxford groups in 1937, we often described ourselves as a nameless bunch of alcoholics. From this phrase, it was only a step to the idea of Alcoholics Anonymous. This was its actual derivation. At the beginning, I had liked this title very much, but as the book naming discussion went on, I began to have certain doubts and temptations. From the start, the title, The Way Out, was popular. If we gave the book this name, then I could add my signature by Bill W. After all, why shouldn't an author sign his book? I began to forget that this was everybody's book and that I had been mostly the umpire of the discussions that had created it. In one dark moment, I even considered calling the book the BW Movement. I whispered these ideas to a few friends and promptly got slapped down. Then I saw the temptation for what it was, a shameless piece of egotism. So once more, I began to vote for the title Alcoholics Anonymous. We considered more than 100 titles all told. In New York, Alcoholics Anonymous had slowly gained in favor. This trend had been helped by the appearance of our first literary light, Joe W., recently scraped out of the Bowery. Years before, he had been one of the founders of a popular and sophisticated magazine. He was all for Alcoholics Anonymous. He made a burning issue out of it, and the majority of the New York group rallied around him. But we had failed to reckon with our friends in Akron. Out there, a considerable majority favored calling our book The Way Out, and the combined voting of the two groups still showed that The Way Out had a bare majority. Here an advantage presented itself, and we seized it. I sent a wire to good old Fitz, then on his farm in Maryland. I asked him to visit the Library of Congress in Washington and find out how many books were entitled The Way Out and how many were called Alcoholics Anonymous. 2 days later, we got this reply. The Library of Congress shows 12 books titled The Way Out. No book there is called Alcoholics Anonymous. We said to ourselves, we sure aren't going to make this book the 13th Way Out. We left the title Alcoholics Anonymous in the copy that went to the printer. That is how we got the title for our book, and that is how our society got its name. Just before the manuscript was finished, an event of great significance for our future took place. At the time, it looked just like another battle over the book. The scene was Henry's office in York, where most of the writing had been done. Present were Fitz, Henry, our grand little secretary, Ruth, and myself. We were still arguing about the 12 steps. All this time, I had refused to budge on these steps. I would not change a word of the original draft, in which, you will remember, I had consistently used the word God, and in one place, the expression on our knees was used. Praying to God on one's knees was still a big affront to Henry. He argued, he begged, he threatened. He quoted Jimmy to back him up. He was positive we would scare off alcoholics by the thousands when they read those 12 steps. Little by little, both Fitz and Ruth came to see merit in his contentions. Though at first I would have none of it, we finally began to talk about the possibility of compromise. Who first suggested the actual compromise words, I do not know. But they are words well known throughout the length and breadth of AA today. In step two, we decided to describe God as a power greater than ourselves. In steps 3 and 11, we inserted the words God as we understood him. From step 7, we deleted the expression on our knees. And as a lead-in sentence to all the steps, we wrote these words. Here are the steps we took which are suggested as a program of recovery. AA's 12 steps were to be suggestions only. Such were the final concessions to those of little or no faith. This was the great contribution of our atheists and agnostics. They had widened our gateway so that all who suffer might pass through, regardless of their belief or lack of belief. God was certainly there in our steps, but he was now expressed in terms that anybody at all could accept and try. Countless AAs have since testified that without this great evidence of liberality, they never could have set foot on any path of spiritual progress or even approached us in the first place. It was another one of those providential 10 strikes. By now, great numbers of the 400 mimeographs which had been sent out had been returned. The total reaction was very good. Indeed, it was wonderful. Many helpful suggestions had been made, and two of these were critically important. One of them came from Dr. Howard, a well-known psychiatrist of Montclair, New Jersey. He pointed out that the text of our book was too full of the words you and must. He suggested that we substitute, wherever possible, such expressions as we ought or we should. His idea was to remove all forms of coercion, to put our fellowship on a we ought basis instead of a you must basis. To make this shift throughout the text of the book would be a big job. I argued weakly against it, but soon gave in. It was perfectly apparent that the doctor was dead right. Dr. Silkworth and Dr. Thiebaud gave us similar advice, and much more besides. And we must never forget that it was Dr. Silkworth who wrote the introduction to the first edition of Alcoholics Anonymous, giving the volume medical standing. All this time, much needed encouragement and advice had come from Dick Richardson, Frank Amos, and Dr. Leonard Strong of our Board of Trustees. They had followed our progress with eager interest and constantly rising hope. It should here be emphasized that the creation of AA's book brought forth much more than disputes about its contents. As the volume grew, so did the conviction that we were on the right track. We saw tremendous vistas of what this book might become and might do. High expectation based on a confident faith was a steady and sustaining overtone of feeling that finally prevailed among us. Like the sound of a receding thunderstorm, the din of our earlier battles was now only a rumble. The air cleared and the sky was bright. We all felt good. In the midst of this rejoicing, still another wonderful thing happened. We had worried about how the world of religion would receive our book. We were not kept waiting long. Dr. Harry Emerson Fosdick expressed his deepest satisfaction with the volume and promised to review it when it was released. The New York group did not contain even one Catholic member at the time the book was in preparation. A Catholic member from Akron had written his story, but had volunteered no further opinion. So we were entirely in the dark as to what Catholic clergymen would say about our book. A group of laymen whose combined religious training and experience had been small indeed had produced a volume which described release from alcoholism by spiritual means. What would our Catholic friends think? We had not the slightest inkling. Then the good news came. By messenger, we had sent the book Alcoholics Anonymous to the Catholic Committee on Publications in the New York Archdiocese. Our messenger was Morgan R., released only a few weeks before from Greystone Asylum, and himself the first Catholic to put in an appearance in New York. It turned out he knew a member of the Church Committee on Publications. So we sent Morgan. Not long after, he returned with wonderful things to tell us. The committee, he said, had nothing but the best to say of our efforts. From their point of view, the book was perfectly all right as far as it went. After reading the section on meditation and prayer, the committee had made certain suggestions for improvement, though none for actual change. Morgan had brought these with him, and they looked so good that we adopted them on the spot. In only one sentence of the entire book had they found it necessary to suggest a real change. At the conclusion of my own story, chapter one of the original draft, I had made a rhetorical flourish to the effect that we have found heaven right here on this good old earth. Morgan's friend on the committee pointed this out to him with a smile and said, "Don't you think that Bill W. could change that word heaven to utopia? After all, we Catholics are promising folks something much better later on." The committee took no official action. They just sent us word that we were all right. Indeed, this has since been the verdict of practically all denominations, a fact for which we are devoutly grateful. Nothing now remained except to prepare the printer's copy of the book. We selected one of the mimeographs, and in Henry's clear handwriting, all the corrections were transferred to it. There were a few large changes, but the small ones were very numerous. The copy was hardly legible, and we wondered if the printer would take it, heavily marked up as it was. Henry and I went to New York and soon found ourselves face to face with Edward Blackwell, president of the Cornwall Press. In high spirits, we told him we were ready to go. Mr. Blackwell wanted to know how many copies we wished. With the promised Reader's Digest article in mind, we were still thinking of carloads. Though doubtless impressed, Mr. Blackwell suggested 5,000 copies for the first printing. Then he asked what financial terms we were able to make. We cautiously let it be known that our cash was temporarily low. Pointing out what the Reader's Digest article would do for us, Henry mentioned a figure of $500 for our first down payment on the 5,000 books. Mr. Blackwell was startled and looked it. "What about that Rockefeller connection?" he asked. We replied that we had better hold that in reserve, that we were trying to manage this thing on our own if we could. Mr. Blackwell, having already caught the AA spirit, said with a twinkle in his eye, "Well, I guess that will do. I'm glad to give you a hand." So the presses were set to roll, and Alcoholics Anonymous had found another wonderful friend. When making these arrangements with Mr. Blackwell, we fixed the retail price of the book at $3.50. This figure was the result of long and heated arguments. Some members had insisted on a $1 book. Others wanted a $2.50 printing. They had turned deaf ears to Henry's plea that we must make something on the deal, or else we could never operate a headquarters office, much less pay off the shareholders. But Henry finally won through, and as a consolation to the contestants, we directed Mr. Blackwell to do the job on the thickest paper in his shop. The original volume proved to be so bulky that it became known as the Big Book. Of course, the idea was to convince the alcoholic purchaser that he was indeed getting his money's worth. Very soon, Henry, Ruth, Dorothy S. of Cleveland, and I wheeled up to Mr. Blackwell's big printing plant at Cornwall, New York, and checked in at the town's only hotel. We brought with us the mangled but precious printer's copy of Alcoholics Anonymous. When the Cornwall manager saw the mess our book was in, he was so dismayed that he almost sent us home to make a fresh typing of the whole business. But salesman Henry prevailed upon him to try to make galleys, and day after day we corrected these as they issued from the shop. By now our money supply was gone. The hotel bill was going to be twice as much as the cash we had. To Ruth and Dorothy and me, this seemed pretty awkward. But Henry stated confidently that God would provide. Henry had lately adopted the comforting theory that if God wanted something done, we only had to keep running up bills, which eventually he would pay. This was a heartening example of faith, but it did leave the practical question of who would be God's agent in the matter of the money. Our stockholders were already loaded for every share they could take. They had had it. Maybe good old Charlie Towns would be the man. So it fell my lot to go to New York and put the touch on him. Mr. Towns was not too favorably impressed when he heard where we stood, but he came through with a hotel bill and about $100 to spare. We took a cheerful view. Soon the book plates would be made, the presses would roll, and 5,000 books would be ready when the Reader's Digest piece broke. Henry and Ruth and I divided the last $100 among us, and we all returned to New York in high spirits. We could be patient now. Prosperity was just around the corner. I will never know why, in all the time during which the book was in preparation, none of us had thought of getting in touch with the Reader's Digest. Somehow, the question of timing their article with the appearance of our book had not occurred to us. As Henry and I again rode up the parkway toward Pleasantville, we wondered about this. We estimated it might take them several months to produce the promised piece. But why worry? It was just a question of time anyhow. We were greeted by managing editor Payne at the door of his office. He did not remember exactly who we were. Henry gaily remarked, "Well, Mr. Managing Editor, we are all ready to shoot." And Mr. Payne, nonplussed, weakly replied, "Shoot what?" Hastily, we brought him up to date, and the memory of our visit during the previous fall came back with a rush. Of course," he said. "I remember you now. You are the representatives of that Fellowship of Alcoholics. You wanted a digest piece about your society in the book you are preparing. You will remember that I told you I had to check this up with our editorial staff. Well, I did. To my surprise, they did not like the idea at all. They did not think there would be much interest in a society of alcoholics. And they thought, besides, that the whole business would be controversial, medically and religiously speaking. And worst of all, I forgot to let you people know. I am so sorry." There's a footnote here that reads, "As many are aware, No publication over the years has since been more generous to AA than the Reader's Digest. It has run many articles in which AA has been featured or prominently mentioned, and it has given us invaluable help in translating our literature into foreign tongues. The late Fulton Arsler was both a senior editor of the Digest and a trustee for Alcoholics Anonymous. This was shattering. Even the buoyant Henry was sunk. We protested, but it was no use. This was it. The book enterprise had collapsed. Writing home in a daze, we wondered how we could face the groups, the stockholders, the printer, and Mr. Towns. The AA Fellowship then had just about 100 members. 28 books had been promised to those who wrote stories, and 49 had to be sent free to stockholders and their friends who had subscribed. Soon, 5,000 books would land in Cornwall's warehouse with no market whatever. Maybe the printer would have to take them over to protect himself. We had not a cent left, and certainly our $500 shoestring payment would not be much compensation to Mr. Blackwell. And what would the trustees say? Maybe they'd been right after all. What would we do? How could we face up to this catastrophe? We had no ideas at all. Our homecoming, however, proved less distressing than we expected. A few of our people grumbled and said, "We told you so." But nearly everybody else took a sporting attitude and asked what had become of our faith. The trustees were mighty nice about it, too. They suggested weekly meetings to consider ways and means of getting the book into circulation. Most cheering of all, Mr. Edward Blackwell said he had no intention of turning our book over to an outside publisher. He would see us through, he said, and so he did, for many an uncertain month and year to come. It was obvious that we had to get some publicity in order to move those books. We tried magazine after magazine with no result. While we were in the midst of these efforts, Cornwall Press told us the printing was ready. It was April 1939. Henry, absolutely broke, was trying to get work. Ruth, living at home, was given meaningless stock certificates in the defunct Works Publishing as pay. She cheerfully accepted these and never slackened her efforts. All of us were going into debt just for living expenses. Then, on May 1st, fresh calamity fell upon 182 Clinton Street. Lois and I had been living in a house which belonged to her parents before their death. The bank had taken it over and rented it to us for a nominal sum. The mortgage was so big, the bank had found great difficulty in selling the place. So we had been able to stay there several years. But at this moment, they found a purchaser, and we had to get out. From its four floors, the old brick house disgorged its furniture into a moving van. The warehouse had to pay the mover, since we could not. All our worldly goods were in hock with the warehouse man, and they were to stay that way for 2 years more. Where could we go? Friends rallied around. A small fund, just about the first money our foundation ever had, was set up as the Lois W. Home Replacement Fund. To this, surrounding AA families began to make tiny contributions. Small, of course, because everybody was broke. Out of this, the trustees began to pay Lois and me $50 a month. A newer member, Jack C., loaned us a battered Lincoln automobile. But where would we live? The question was settled by Howard and his mother, who owned a summer camp on a remote lake in western New Jersey. Here we stayed until snow flew in November. This interval gave us the needed opportunity to revive the bankrupt book project. Shortly after the publication of Alcoholics Anonymous in April, Dr. Fosdick had beautifully reviewed the book, just as he promised. His review was reprinted, chiefly by religious periodicals, but it had no influence so far as book orders were concerned. We were delighted when the New York Times also gave us a review, but nothing happened. We still had no book orders. Right through the summer of 1939, all attempts to get national magazines to print pieces about Alcoholics Anonymous failed. Then one day, Morgan, our Irishman, came up with an idea. He said, "I used to be in the ad business and had a good deal to do with radio. I know Gabriel Heater very well, and I'm sure he would give us a hand. So off he went to see Heater, and soon he was back, all smiles. "Sure thing," he said. "Gabriel is going to give us a lift." In those days, Mr. Heater was on a national network with a program called We the People, consisting of 3-minute interviews. Our story appealed to him at once. He planned to interview Morgan, quickly sketching his fall and rise, and then to elicit from him some facts about AA and put in a plug for the book. This, we thought, was simply great, and on a national hookup, too. Henry's promotional instincts were instantly revived. In connection with the broadcast, he wanted to send a shower of postal cards to all physicians east of the Mississippi River. There were said to be some 20,000 of them. The card would exhort them to listen to the Heater broadcast and buy the book Alcoholics Anonymous, A Sure Cure for Alcoholism. Here was another wonderful idea. All we needed was money. Among our new prospects, a couple of the more prosperous variety had just turned up. Henry went after them, brandishing his pad of Works Publishing stock certificates. They did not want any stock, but they would take promissory notes signed by the defunct publishing company and personally endorsed by Henry and me. Quite unbelievably, Henry extracted $500 from them. A list of all physicians in the eastern United States was obtained from an agency which also designed the postcard mailing. This made us feel sure of at least a few thousand book orders. Gabriel Heater, meanwhile, had set a date for Morgan's appearance before his microphone. It was only a week away, and we were very excited. With some of the past fiascos in mind, somebody sounded a note of caution. What if the lately released asylum inmate Morgan should be drunk the day of the broadcast? Hard experience told us this was a real possibility. How could such a calamity be averted? Very gently, we suggested to a resentful Morgan that he would have to be locked up somewhere until the night of the broadcast. It took all of Salesman Henry's wiles to put this one over, but he did. How and where we would lock him up was the only remaining question. Henry, with full faith now restored, solemnly declared that God would provide. He recalled that one of the prosperous newcomers had a membership in the downtown athletic club. If we paid the charges, could a double room be arranged? Grumbling loudly, Morgan was conducted into captivity. For several days, we took turns staying with him right around the clock, never letting him get out of our sight. The postal card shower to the doctors was on its way, and all was ready. Why had we not thought of radio before? This would be only a starter. Once more, talk was heard of book sales in carload lots. An hour before broadcast time, our whole membership and their families gathered about their radios to wait for the great moment. Sure enough, Gabriel spoke up right on the dot. Sighs of relief went up in every New York member's home when Morgan's voice was heard. He had hit the deadline without getting drunk. It was a heart-stirring 3 minutes. Gabriel Heater saw to that, and he was well assisted by Morgan, who was no slouch as a radio man. We figured that the impact on America would be terrific, especially on the doctors who had already got our 20,000 postal cards. Within 3 days, we figured that Post Office Box 658, Church Street Annex, New York City, would be flooded with pleas for help and book orders. By a great effort of self-restraint, we kept away for 3 whole days. Then we marched up the steps of the post office and headed straight for our box, each of us armed with a couple of suitcases to bring home some part of the first great influx. Peering through the glass, we were stunned to see less than a handful of postal cards. Henry, the optimist, rallied to exclaim, "Think nothing of it, folks. They just couldn't get them into the box. I'll bet they've got a whole mail bag full out back." The mail clerk handed us exactly 12 cards. Henry said to the clerk, "There must be a lot more. Where are they?" And the clerk replied, "This is all there is, sir." Sick clear through, we looked through the 12. Some ribbed us unmercifully. Others, evidently inscribed by medics in their cups, were totally illegible. The 2 remaining cards were orders for the book Alcoholics Anonymous. Radio as a medium lost considerable stature in our eyes. and another $500 had gone down the drain. A few days later, our landlord in Newark got really tough. The sheriff appeared with an eviction notice. So, in a nearby office building, we found a tiny room, barely big enough to contain Henry's large desk, his overstuffed chair, a couple of file cases, and Ruth and her typewriter. For callers, there was standing room only. Somehow, we made a small down payment on the rent, wondering how many months it would be before the sheriff showed up once more. Howard's summer camp, facing the untroubled waters of the lake, was a wonderful place to relax and recoup. Besides, we had $50 a month and a car to get around in. But what would happen when winter came? Lois began to wonder if she should not have kept her department store job. And prospects for the book had looked the brightest. I had persuaded her to quit. There was now nothing left but to press on. Somehow that book project must be revived. I confess we often reflected that after nearly 4 years of my sobriety, we had no prospect of any income or the certainty of any place to live. By July, Henry had found himself a job, and so the revival of the book project was left pretty much up to Ruth and me. She was still on a theoretical salary of $25 a week, but that now consisted of a weekly ration of one Works Publishing Stock Certificate, par $25. Not a cent of cash could we give her. It wasn't until the following October that we could pay her anything. One day in July, I went into New York City, where I visited Mr. Charles Towns. As in the case of Mr. Blackwell of Cornwall Press, we owed Charlie plenty of money, but both men had cheerfully gone along. As I stepped off the elevator onto the hospital roof garden, Charlie greeted me with a broad smile. He had been raising heaven and earth to get publicity for us, and had succeeded. He had known Morris Markey, a well-known feature writer, for years. Intrigued with the story of AA, Mr. Markey had approached Fulton Owsler, then editor of Liberty Magazine. That great editor, writer, and friend-to-be had instantly seen the possibilities and had commissioned Morris Markey to do a piece. So, inquired Charlie, when can you go to work with Morris? To our great delight, Morris soon hammered out an article which he titled Alcoholics and God. It was to appear in the September issue of Liberty. This time we really hoped and believed that we had turned the corner. And indeed we had. But it would be October before we could get book orders as a result of the coming piece. What were we to do for money meanwhile? The rent would have to be paid, and something ought to be done for Messrs. Blackwell, Towns, and certain other creditors. We simply had to find at least $1,000. One of our New York AAs, Bert T., had a fashionable tailoring shop on Fifth Avenue, which he had inherited from his father. But Bert's drinking had pretty nearly demolished the business, and it was still going downhill. I phoned Bert and told him what we needed. When I said that Liberty would surely print a piece in September, he said, "Are you really sure this time? After all, you and Henry were awfully sure about the Reader's Digest piece. But come on down. Maybe I can do something." Bert's clothing clients included many wealthy customers. Scanning the list, he chose one, whom we shall call Mr. G. Bert said, "Now here's a man who knows all about us. He is extremely interested in the alcohol problem, though I must admit he is on the bone dry side of the argument." When I expressed doubt about accepting help from a dry crusader, Bert wryly remarked, "Listen, Bill, this is no time to quibble. We have got to get $1,000 from anybody who will give it to us." Bert went to the phone and asked for long distance. At first, he boldly asked Mr. G for a contribution. Mr. G was uncertain. Then Bert told his customer about Works Publishing, which at the moment had a large inventory of books, but little cash. The Liberty piece, however, would bring in plenty of orders. Would Mr. G care to buy some stock? Mr. G was still more dubious. Then Bert proposed that Mr. G make Works Publishing a loan. After all, the company had a large inventory of valuable books. Upon learning the true state of Works Publishing, Mr. G emphatically declined. Bert tried once more. Mr. G, Bert said, would you take the promissory note of Works Publishing for $1,000 if I endorsed it? As you know, I have a fine business right here on Fifth Avenue. Most certainly, said Mr. G. I will take such a note if you endorse it. Send it right down, and I'll be delighted to send you the money. This was a real godsend, which probably saved the book company, for it kept us going until the late fall of 1939. Bert had hocked his own business, virtually bankrupt by then, to save the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. This was a friend indeed.